Hello? My name's Mick Isaacson. I'm going to talk to you about ambiguity in spoken mathematics. And could we get the first slide? Hello? Okay, so I wanted to start off by maybe putting ambiguity in spoken mathematics into a perspective. And go back in your way back machines back to, say, about 1999, when NASA shot the orbiter up and it missed Mars. The reason it missed Mars was because of inconsistent communication of mathematics. Inconsistent communication of mathematics. The Lockheed Martin group were using English units of measurements, and another team was using the metric system. So because of that miscommunication, that thing just flew by Mars and missed Mars. So that was a big faux pas, and that's all because of miscommunication of mathematics, and that's a big consequence. Would you hit the next slide? Another consequence has to do with decreased knowledge, access to knowledge. And some students may be more susceptible to decreased access to knowledge. So would you hit the next one, please? Ambiguity in spoken mathematics is what we're going to talk about. Ambiguity is particularly problematic for students who have print disabilities. Would you hit the next one, please? So what is it that we mean by ambiguity in spoken mathematics? We're going to look at a few examples. Could you hit the next one? Here's an example. Consider this utterance. The square root of A plus B plus C. Now, think about that for a second. There's three interpretations of that. And would you hit the next one, please? The interpretations are, okay, so do we all know what a radical sign is? That's a thing that looks like a check mark with a hat over the top going from left to right on the page. It's a mathematical symbol that's called a radical. So there's three interpretations. A plus B plus C can be contained within, we'll just call it the hat of the radical. It could just be the A plus the B within the hat, within the radical, or just the A within the radical, and everything else is to the left of the radical. So there's three interpretations of that relatively simple utterance. I could come up with equations that have, you know, dozens of possible interpretations, but that gives you an idea of what we're talking about when we say ambiguity in spoken mathematics. Would you please hit the next slide? Okay, so we looked at, gave you an example of ambiguity using roots or radicals. It's all throughout mathematics. It can be found with groupings, with superscripts, logarithms, subscripts, superscripts, matrices, absolute values, and fractions, and just about any other thing that you can think of. So it's ubiquitous. It's all throughout mathematics. Would you hit the next slide, please? Okay, you might think I'm crazy, but I actually spent time looking through math textbooks to see how much ambiguity was actually in the textbooks. I actually didn't do it for that purpose. I did it for another study, but as a consequence, we took some math textbooks and we went through them, and we systematically went through from the beginning to the end, and we just sampled problems, and we looked at them for having the potential to be spoken ambiguously. Would you hit the next slide, please? Of the text, of the equations, we had a whole big sample. We had 1,500 plus equations that we looked at. So about 75% of them had potential ambiguity if they were to be spoken using typical everyday speech. So that's a lot of potential ambiguity that's out there. And where are they coming? It's coming from textbooks. What do teachers use when they communicate, when they teach, when they talk to their students? They typically pull it from a textbook. So that's the source material that has a lot of ambiguity. Would you hit the next slide, please? We actually also took some of those equations, a subset of them, and we gave them to teachers, and we asked them, would you read these equations that had potential ambiguity in them? Would you read them aloud as if you were presenting them to your class? Then we went back and we took the recordings and we analyzed them for whether they were spoken ambiguously. What do you think we found? Yeah, a lot of them were spoken ambiguously. Would you hit the next slide? Specifically, 86% of those were spoken ambiguously. And we had a very liberal criteria for saying, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt, you know. So this is very liberal criteria. So there's a lot of potential ambiguity in mathematics. It's in the source materials that teachers use. Teachers speak it ambiguously. So that's a potentially big problem for students with print disabilities. Okay, let's go to the next slide, please. Dr. Nemeth, he was a professor of mathematics. He was a blind professor. He recently passed away. Do you recognize the name? Okay, I figured you did. He found that when he was studying to become a mathematician, that the ambiguity in spoken mathematics was inhibiting him from learning mathematics. So he actually developed a set of informal rules for communicating with his teachers, his professors, his readers, so that they could communicate back and forth non-ambiguously. Would you hit the next slide, please? So yeah, I just talked to you about that. Nemeth developed a set of non-ambiguous rules for speaking mathematics. Would you hit the next slide, please? Recently, GHLLC, along with Dr. Nemeth, developed and took the rules that Nemeth had been informally developing and kind of tried to develop them into more of a standardized set of rules. So they've become known as mass speak rules. Purdue researcher, that would be me at the time, I was a Purdue researcher, took the rules and we did an efficacy test on them to see if they actually did disambiguate the ambiguity in spoken mathematics. Okay, would we go to the next slide, please? Yes, and what we found was that the MassSpeak rules were very efficacious at disambiguating the ambiguity. And they were pretty simple to do, pretty simple to learn. And would you hit the next slide, please? We did an efficacy study where I had education students in the looking to become teachers. They were in the education department. They came in and they listened to some instructions on mass speak. And they had about 5 minutes of training. After 5 minutes of training, and we just used radicals and fractions, superscripts and absolute values. We couldn't, you know, go in 5 minutes through the whole gamut of everything that's in mathematics. But after 5 minutes of training, and actually it was a little less, they were performing at next to ceiling levels. They were almost at 100% accurately taking what they heard and understanding it non-ambiguously. So accuracy was close to 100%. Could we hit the next slide? Okay, just to go back through everything I just went through. Textbook content has the high potential of being rendered ambiguously. It's spoken with everyday speech. That was some of the data we just saw. Teachers tend to speak everyday speech when speaking mathematics. So they're communicating ambiguously. Ambiguity in communication can be problematic, particularly for students with print disabilities. Both teachers and students should learn how to communicate mathematics non-ambiguously. That's a suggestion. And could we go to the next slide? We have a few exercises. This is not XXX, you know, rated or whatever. But I have a few exercises to go through with you guys, if you're so inclined, to show you how easy it is to learn the rules. And would you like to? Okay, so you're passing out stuff? This is my assistant. Okay, I'm going to read out. No. This is what I read out. This is my utterance, just to read aloud. We need. Okay. First, I'm going to give you some training. Then I'm going to read some equations out loud, and you're going to write them down using mass speak. Can we get the first slide? Okay. A general rule is that ambiguity arises from the failure to demarcate the beginning and the end of an instance of ambiguity. Keep that in mind as we go through the next examples. Would you hit the next slide, please? Okay, so the square root of a plus b, it has two interpretations. The a plus b can be contained within the radical, or just the a could be contained within the radical. Would you hit the next slide? Okay, so the ambiguity is arising from the failure to demarcate the beginning of the radical and the end of the radical. That's where the ambiguity in that instance was arising. Could you go to the next slide, please? Okay, if we were to use the mass speak rules, in the example where the a and the b are both contained within the radical, we would speak it as start root. We're indicating the beginning of the instance of potential ambiguity. Start root, a plus b, end root. We're demarcating the end of the potential instance of ambiguity. Would you go to the next slide, please? For the example where just the a was contained within the radical sign, it is start root. Again, we're indicating the beginning of the potential instance of where ambiguity is going to occur. A is what's within the radical, within the root. End root, so we're demarcating the end of the root. And then plus B, that's what's outside of the instance of an ambiguity, the root. Would you hit the next slide, please? So for the radicals, the demarcating the beginning of the end of the radical essentially is what's removing the ambiguity. Could we go to the next slide, please? we're going to talk about fractions. Fractions, it's the same basic thing. You need to demarcate the beginning and the end of the fraction. Okay, so we start by saying start fraction. In the example here, I have the number 1 over a plus b. If I said 1 over a plus b, that's actually ambiguous. So we would do it non-ambiguously by demarcating the beginning of the fraction, start fraction, 1 over a plus b, end fraction. That's how you would apply the mass speak rules. Beginning of the fraction, the end of the fraction. That's where the ambiguity comes. That's where you demarcate the beginning and the end. Could we get to the next slide, please? Sometimes you have a fraction within a fraction, or you have a radical within a radical, or stuff of that sort. Mathematically, they call it nesting. So if you got a nested fraction, you have a fraction within a fraction. And if it's a single, if it's a just one level of nesting, you start by saying start fraction. That indicates that it's a fraction that has nesting within it. Okay? Now in this particular example, I have 1 over a plus b, and that whole thing is over c. So we would start by saying start fraction. The middle, the stuff, the nested fraction is over. So the over is the middle indicator now. It's indicating that the stuff above is basically nested. So in this example, sometimes it's easier to get it through an example. Start fraction, 1, and then we would indicate the start of the fraction that's nested. Start fraction 1 over a plus b. So I'm demarcating the beginning of the fraction that's nested in the numerator. Is that clear, or am I rambling? Okay. And then, of course, it's 1 over a plus b, end fraction, over, and it's over c. And then we indicate that it's the end of the nested fraction by end fraction. So the nesting is start, and the beginning of the nesting is start. The end of the nesting is end. Could we go to the next slide? Radicals can be nested also. But we're not going to get, let's just talk about non-nested radicals for the time being. If you don't have a root index, by default, it's a square root. If you have a root index, then you've got to indicate what the root is. Square roots are implied, they're not spoken. We kind of went over this before. You start by indicating the beginning of the fraction, the beginning of the radical would start root, then you indicate the end with end root. Could we go to the next next slide? For example, there's on the screen we see the letter Z and it's contained within the radical sign. This would be spoken using the mass speak rules as start root Z end root. I have another example where we actually have a root. The root is m plus n. This one would be spoken as root index m. So you're indicating the index or the root by the root index, m plus n, and then start root, x plus y, end root. So the x plus y are contained within the radical sign. And again, we're indicating the end with the end root. Could we go to the next example? For nested radicals, you start by saying nested start root. So it's a little bit different than the other ones in that you're actually indicating nesting. So I have up on the screen an example where I have one radical sign and I have two roots contained within that radical. I have the square root of x plus the square root of y. Those are separate entities within the larger radical. This one would be spoken as nested start root because those two, the x plus y contained within the radical, are nested within the larger radical sign. Nested start root x, end root plus, and then we're starting the root and of the y, start root y, end root, nested, end root. So things that are nested, you have to indicate that they're starting and ending. And then the beginning of the nesting is spoken as nested start root. It's a little different than the fractions, but it gives you the same demarcation of the beginning and the end of a potential instance of ambiguity. Would we go to the next one? We're going to talk a little bit about superscripts and subscripts. For a single superscript, we would use the word superscript. If there's a superscript within a superscript, it's kind of like a nesting type of thing. We would say superscript. So that's indicating that there's an exponent within an exponent. Now, in this particular case with subscripts and superscripts, the failure to indicate that you're returning to baseline is the problem where the ambiguity usually arises. So you have to say baseline to say that you're returning back to baseline. If you don't, then everything you're saying is still contained within the super or subscript. So that's baseline in this particular instance is the way that you're indicating the end of that potential instance of ambiguity. So remember, baseline, end of the instance of ambiguity. That's important. And that's what a lot of teachers don't indicate. They fail to indicate that they've returned to baseline. And it's the same basic thing for subscripts. Subscripts are just numbers below the line. You know, and if it's a if it's nested, it's sub, you know, that kind of stuff. But you always got to return to baseline. Otherwise, everything you're saying thereafter is still within the super or the subscript. Okay, could we go to the next slide? Okay, I'm just going to go through a few examples. There's an X with M. What happened to it? Oh, I'm sorry. There's the up on the screen. There's X with M plus N in the as a superscript. So in this particular case, it would be X superscript M plus N, because there's nothing following it. It's implied that it's returning to baseline. In the next example, there's a nested superscript. So we would say X superscript M. M is the first superscript. Superscript N. That's the nesting, the superscript, super. In the next example, we have a X with a superscript M plus N. And then we return to baseline. So we need to demarcate the baseline. And then we have, in the baseline, continuing after that, the letter Y. So in this particular example, we would read it as X superscript M plus N baseline. There's that baseline. Return back to baseline plus Y. Okay, could we go to the next screen, please? Okay, this is the demonstration. Hey, Michelle, does anybody need Perkin-Brailers to write out the equations? I'm going to read some stuff, and you're going to write it down in mass speak, and then we're going to see how well you do.